Everybody get back. Everybody get
back. Don't get hurt. Don't get hurt.
Where
are we? Is this us? Hey, just want to say, tell everybody, it live stream on Getter right now. Everybody watching in the war room, we're here today. I don't want anybody to take their eye off the ball of what we do every day. Okay, we got the Hispanics coming on our side, African Americans coming on our side. We're taking down the Biden regime. I want you guys to stay focused, stay on message. Remember, signal, not noise. This is all noise, that's signal. Thank you very much.
Former Trump White House advisor Steve Bannon, as he showed up to the FBI's Washington field office earlier today to turn himself in after being indicted on contempt of Congress charges. And in true 2021 fashion, he live-streamed his arrival on the Trump-friendly conservative social media platform Getter. Bannon has refused to provide information to a House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We're going to talk about several fronts in Trump's ongoing battle against the committee investigating the insurrection and his role in it with Jessica Levinson. She's a professor at Loyola Law School and a regular legal here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so we heard him live streaming his arrival, delivering this message, I guess, to his supporters in real time. And then he walks into the FBI's office. Then what happens?
So he made an initial appearance today in federal court before a magistrate judge, as is typically the case. The magistrate judge basically said, you know what, we're not going to be doing the arraignment today. We'll do it next week. Does this mean that he's guilty or not guilty? Absolutely not. It just means they're going to be doing the arraignment next week, not today. And then he's going to enter his plea. And at that point, we'll know how much back and forth, how much legal wrangling there's going to be here. Not a lot of the facts in this case are in dispute, and the law is fairly clear. So the question, I think, will just be more of a political one, which is how long does Steve Bannon want to fight this? And the answer is it's probably politically very advantageous for him to drag this out as long as he possibly can.
Okay, so you say it's pretty clear. The facts are pretty clear in this case. He was ordered to provide information. I believe there are two counts of contempt of Congress. One was providing information, one was testifying. He refused to do both. He's not saying that he didn't refuse, right? He's agreeing, as far as we know.
So, well, everybody agrees he did not, in fact, walk into that congressional chamber and talk. And everybody agrees, you know, he did not give any documentary evidence. So yes, of course, in this case, there are two counts, as you said, of contempt of Congress, one because he didn't show up to testify and the other because he didn't provide documents. And what's in dispute really is whether or not he has a legal reason to fail to respond. And Congress, of course, in this case has said, no, we have our constitutionally based investigatory authority here, and we're trying to figure out if there was a coup. Yeah, we're trying to figure out what exactly you knew and what others knew. And the only way to do that is, in fact, to hear from you. And what Steve Bannon here is saying is, well, the former president of the United States told me not to comply, and he told me that my testimony might be covered by, or he believes is covered by, executive privilege. So that's really his defense here.
That he is protected by executive privilege, even though he was not working in the White House at the time.
Even though he was not working in the White House, and former President Trump is, of course, the former president. So there's a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to executive privilege. I actually just spoke to some undergrads about the doctrine of executive privilege this morning, and I started out with executive privilege question because it is vague and amorphous, but this is a weak executive privilege argument here, because he's trying to basically piggyback off of what I believe is former President Trump's already weak argument, but hard to see how a former advisor would be able to piggyback off of a former president's claim of executive privilege, which, let's remember, has been rejected by the White House counsel, who essentially said, you don't get to try to potentially undermine the Constitution, but then use constitutional doctrines to protect yourself.
Yeah, it's a little ironic. But the fact that this is the first time in nearly 40 years someone has been charged with contempt of Congress says something that it says it's not invoked very often. But I guess I'm wondering why, if it is, as you describe it, such an open and shut case in this particular instance. Why have there been relatively few cases of this?
Right. Well, I should say that the statute on contempt of Congress is clear that it's there and that it exists, and the facts are clear. Now, there will still be some legal wrangling about the scope of executive privilege, but I do think that this is a very strong case against Steve Bannon. Now, to your question about, like, why haven't we seen this in four decades? The answer is kind of something we've been talking about for the last 5 years, which is that a lot of behavior has not created certain situations until now. So, or at least for 40 years, meaning typically when somebody faces a congressional subpoena and they're asked to testify about, let's say, three topics, and they're asked to give over, let's say, seven boxes of documents, then there's a period of something called accommodation where the person says, look, I'll talk about two topics and I'll give you four boxes of documents. And then each side kind of goes up and back, they negotiate, and then nobody's particularly happy, but they agree. It's not very common that you just have somebody not respond at all. I mean, that's not what we're used to. That still is norm breaking. Can we point to a couple of high profile examples? Of course, but this is not the norm.
So what does this mean for others, specifically former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who was an executive branch employee on January 6th? So maybe he might have a stronger case for invoking executive privilege.
Yeah, I think that his case, as you say, it is different because he was, in fact, working for the White House at the time. And it's, I can imagine it being slightly different for the Biden White House if they're asked to weigh in, because, of course, every current president, when they're thinking about a claim of executive privilege, is thinking, well, what if this happened to me? What if somebody subpoenaed my White House chief of staff? Having said that, I do think the Congress is on really strong constitutional grounds here. We know that they have investigatory authority over questions like this, and there's really no way to get the answers that they need without calling in somebody like Mark Meadows. So I think he has to be looking at this indictment and thinking, oh my gosh, the Department of Justice is not, in fact, joking around here. Now, there's another case that he'll look at dealing with documents that are held by the National Archives, probably to try and get kind of signals of where the court's going in that case. But it's a strong signal to other witnesses.
Okay. And speaking of signals, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. He is, of course, chair of the House Intelligence Committee and also a member of this January 6th committee. And this is what he said with regards to Mark Meadows.
I'm confident we'll move very quickly with respect to Mr. Meadows also. But we want to make sure that we have the strongest possible case to present to the Justice Department and for the Justice Department to present to a grand jury. And that means making sure that we bend over backwards to reach any agreement we can with witnesses that are showing any willingness to engage. But when ultimately witnesses decide, as Meadows has, that they're not even going to bother showing up, that they have that much contempt for the law, then it pretty much forces our hand and we'll move quickly.
So it is a matter of time, right? Because the clock is running out in terms of the Democratic control of the House. All signs point to a difficulty in keeping the House in the midterm elections. So is the strategy on the part of Meadows, Bannon, and others to just run out the clock and hope for the best in terms of a changeover in the House?
I think yes, yes, and yes. And I think it's not just that the House knows that there might, the House Select Committee understands there might be a changeover, at which point the committee will cease to exist. But I also think it's a political calculation that going into the midterms, a lot of our lawmakers understand people are concerned about how much did I just spend at the gas pump? How much did my groceries cost? And while January 6th, of course, is deeply important when it comes to the strength of our Constitution, a lot of voters, I think, will get impatient. So it's both control of the House, and I also think it's a political calculation that voters just don't want this to continue. And frankly, the same calculation that the House impeachment committees made when they just decided to go forward with impeachment instead of fight in the courts for those witnesses that had been subpoenaed and failed to show up.
Meanwhile, there's a related case also happening, and this is a dispute between Trump and the National Archives over documents related to January 6th. And President Biden has said that executive privilege does not qualify to protect these documents from being released. So what's the latest on that?
So the latest is that a district court agreed with the Biden administration and said, yes, turn over these documents to the National Archives, give these documents to the Congressional Committee. President Trump appealed that decision to a circuit court, and the circuit court did exactly what it typically does, which is it says, okay, let's just push pause. Let's keep the status quo, which is for the National Archives to keep the documents, and said, we're going to set oral arguments for November 30th. So people might have read a headline and thought, oh my gosh, former President Trump won. The National Archives isn't going to have to turn over the documents. That's just for now. It's very temporary. I think the Court of Appeals will look at this and will realize that, again, it's a really weak argument for executive privilege.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and a regular legal eagle here on Press Play. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Coming up, revisiting a politically motivated armored car robbery that ended in death. One of the men convicted, the father of the current San Francisco DA, will walk free this month. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Chesa Boudin was elected 2 years ago as San Francisco's DA, riding a wave of support for progressive prosecutors. He promised to eliminate cash bail and re-examine wrongful convictions. And he ran on his personal story about how nearly his entire life has been shaped by the criminal justice system.
The CBS Evening News with Dan Rather.
Good evening. Echoes of the violent radical underground of the 1960s rolled over the New York suburb of Nanuet today in the botched ambush of an armored car that left one guard and two policemen dead. Among the four suspects arrested was Catherine Boudin.
That's Chesa Boudin's mom, a member of the Weather Underground who drove one of the getaway cars in that 1981 robbery of a Brinks truck. She had left her infant son with a babysitter that day. Chesa's father, David Gilbert, was also involved in the getaway. Neither pulled the trigger, but they were still convicted of murder for their role in the robbery. Chesa Boudin was raised by fellow Weather Underground members Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. Kathy Boudin was paroled in 2003, and last month, New York State granted parole to David Gilbert. He'll be released before the end of November. We're going to look back on that crime now, how it affected the New York communities in which it took place, with Mike Barlow. Back in 1981, he was a reporter for the Rockland Journal News, and he covered the Brinks robbery and the subsequent trial. I spoke with Barlow back in August after then-New York Governor Andrew Cuomo granted David Gilbert clemency.
This is one of those indigestible and inexplicable points in American history. I mean, just thinking about the Brinks robbery makes me sad, even after the passage of 40 years.
Hmm. And that's because you knew the two officers who were killed that day, right?
Yes, I had covered several homicides before that, but this one was and remains different because I knew the victims, two of the victims, NYAC police officers, Eddie O'Grady and Chipper Brown. And I had interviewed them, I had worked with them, they had helped me retrieve the keys to my car that I somehow always managed to lock. And Eddie and Chipper were always there to get my car unlocked for me. So it was very strange and quite frankly traumatic to suddenly have them killed on an October day by people who came from a different environment and who had a political agenda that at the moment just seemed very, very out of touch with the times.
Right. And also, here you are in a pretty sleepy community in the Hudson Valley, and this major event takes place. Can you describe what happened? Because it was almost like two events, really. There was the robbery and then the getaway, and there was violence at both scenes. Can you describe what happened that day?
Yeah. So they identified the Weather Underground. Kind of teamed up with elements of the Weather Underground teamed up with elements of the Black Liberation Army, and they robbed a Brinks truck at the Nanuet Mall, and they killed one of the guards there, Peter Page, it was a kind of a carefully organized plan. You know, clearly there was a lot of planning, but plans never work out the way you think they will. And then they tried to escape, and they did something that anybody who lived in Rockland County knows you shouldn't do, which is to try to go down Route 59 and make it to the Tappan Zee Bridge within a couple of minutes, because that on a map looks like it's possible, but in reality, you just can't do it. It's impossible. And by then, Eddie O'Grady and Chipper Brown and Artie Keenan and Brian Lennon had set up a checkpoint at the entrance to the thruway that led right to the bridge. And that's where the tragedy really just, you know, blew up in everybody's face.
So Kathy was driving the U-Haul getaway vehicle, right? And then David was driving another car when they approached this checkpoint?
You know, I honestly don't remember. The important thing was is that Chipper and Eddie had been told that the perpetrators were black males, and David and Kathy were white. And that basically created just enough ambiguity and uncertainty in Eddie and Chipper's minds that they dropped their guard. And at that moment, a bunch of armed robbers, you know, popped out of the back of the truck, and the shooting started. And the robbers had automatic weapons, and Eddie and Chipper were no match for them.
But neither Kathy nor David shot or fired a weapon, right?
For one, I wasn't there at the moment that it happened. And to me, that's a fine point. You know, as a member of the community, you know, and as a human being, I don't hold with murder for political purposes. And that's what this was. Looking at it purely from a journalistic perspective, this was a triple homicide. And you really can't get around that. There's no excusing it. There's no rationale. There's nothing that you can say that makes this okay. This is something that was very bad. And no matter what they were thinking right before it happened, the fact that they participated in this triple homicide really makes you have to think that, you know, it really, really forces you to think about your own views on reconciliation, forgiveness, mercy, all of those qualities. That's when we're forced to really deal with them, because there's no excusing what they did.
I want to play another clip of tape from that CBS Evening News package from 1981. And this is where the reporter is describing Kathy Boudin and how she had been a fugitive for the past 11 years before this event. Here it is.
Kathy Boudin fled from the scene of a 1970 explosion that destroyed an elegant New York townhouse, killing three other members of the Weather Underground. Police said the building was being used as a bomb factory. Like so many of the Weather people, Kathy Boudin came from an affluent, middle-class family. She was a magna cum laude graduate of Bryn Mawr, intelligent, idealistic, and attractive, but then finally an advocate of violent revolution.
So what was their goal in this Brinks robbery? What did they want the money for?
The goal was to extend the revolution. It was to fund their activities and to make sure that they had cash so they could buy weapons and explosives and continue their plans. The weird thing is that, you know, for those of us who are old enough to remember, the 80s were really a time at which collectively as a culture, we kind of decided that the 60s and the 70s were over. And so to a certain extent, this was just the timing, this was all wrong. So, you know, even if they'd gotten away with the money, they still would not have accomplished their goals, because the world had moved on. And although many of the issues that they were trying to correct are still issues and they still need to be worked on, the idea of a violent revolution within the United States, that time, that moment had passed.
And so at the time, how did this affect the people in those communities to have this really supercharged event of revolution come to their community?
Well, it was horrific. And so people were extremely upset. They were upset, they were angry, they were sad. Every emotion that could possibly come to the surface came to the surface. And again, there was this sense that, like, why did you come and do this in our village? You know, we were a place that were working. We were working really hard to make ourselves open and inclusive and diverse. This was before any of this stuff was considered cool. We were doing it because it was just a very, very special place. And so the idea that this revolution that could never possibly be successful cost the lives of three people and put a stain, it really, you know, and I'm not talking about reputation. I'm just talking about it's almost like a karmic stain that it put on our existence. And that was really, really painful for people. I'm, you know, I'm making it sound a little too spiritual, but what I'm saying really is that people were really angry. You know, they felt violated. They felt that the people, they felt that Kathy and David and Judy and, you know, didn't understand what was going on at that moment in the world. You know, it was like they'd come from another planet.
And over the years, did David or Kathy, did they ever express remorse for what happened? And
Yes, they have. And I don't have any doubt that their remorse is real. But, you know, as my dad would say, apologies will only take you so far. And I don't mean to sound like Old Testament-y here, but there is a certain truth. When you murder somebody, you can't walk that back. And that's what I think that's what makes this whole event so indigestible. And you can probably hear the emotion in my voice because I consider myself a peaceful, enlightened, and forgiving person. But I, you know, when you know people who are perfectly fine people, and by the way, they were municipal employees, you know, when they clocked in that day, their goal was to give parking tickets, not become involved in this really pointless exercise in political theater, you know, that resulted in the deaths of people and the ruining of many, many lives.
So David Gilbert spent 40 years in prison. And Cuomo, as I mentioned, is granting him clemency. He cited a lot of the good work that David Gilbert did behind bars, like AIDS education and prevention. And as you say, he has expressed remorse. What would you say to people who think that 40 years behind prison for someone who didn't physically pull the trigger and who has led an exemplary life behind bars is enough punishment?
It's a great question and one that I will sidestep because, you know, there are two realities here. There's the reality that three people got murdered, and then there's the reality of time, the passage of time. This was 40 years ago, and it's important to live in the present. I completely understand why Chesa Boudin would lobby hard to get his father released from prison. That also is a completely natural and completely understandable action on his part. I can also understand why people would be angry that Governor Cuomo or former Governor Cuomo signed off on this. Redemption is possible, forgiveness is possible, and mercy is really, really essential. Those are all really important things. But nothing is going to remove the fact that they murdered three people who really didn't deserve to be murdered. Not that nobody deserves to be murdered. And I guess the reason why I feel emotionally entangled in this is because I knew two of the victims.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your memories with us.
Thank you.
That's Mike Barlow. He was a reporter for the Rockland Journal News back in 1981 during the Brinks armored car robbery. Coming up, why you may be allergic to cats.
It's this little protein called FeLD1. And kind of contrary to belief, it's not necessarily in their fur. It's in their saliva and it's in their oil glands.
So can humans bioengineer cats to just not have that protein anymore, creating a perfect companion next on Press Play? This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Having a cat allergy can be serious business. The sneezing, the runny nose, the itchy, watery eyes, the wheezing. But what if you could genetically engineer an allergen-free feline? What could go wrong?
Don't you see the danger inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should.
Okay, it's not quite Jurassic Park-level dystopian yet, but life finds a way. And scientists are using biotechnology right now to try to make cats hypoallergenic. Sarah Zhang is a science writer for The Atlantic. She's been writing about this. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, first of all, what is it about cats that makes us, or many of us, so allergic to them?
Yeah, it's this little protein called FeLD1. So actually, there's kind of a bunch of different things that can cause cat allergies. But for most people who are allergic, it's this one protein called FeLD1. And kind of contrary to belief, it's like not necessarily in their fur. It's in their saliva and it's in their oil glands. So what happens is when cats groom themselves and then their fur kind of gets all over the place, that protein also gets all over the place. So it's not in the fur itself, but it's kind of like just all over the cats. And when it dries, it kind of gets in the air, you know, it gets on your bed, it gets on your couch. It can really get everywhere.
Yeah. So what purpose does it serve for the cats? Why do they have this protein?
That is a great question, and it's been a kind of a question of research for decades. So the short answer is, unfortunately, we don't really know. There's a lot of variation in cats over how much FeLD1 they shed. You know, listeners might have noticed, who are allergic might have noticed that themselves, that sometimes they'll be fine around the cat, and then around another cat, they'll get really allergic. So there's a lot of variation. Some cats might shed as much as 100 times as much of this protein as others. We also find that male cats tend to shed more than female cats, and especially intact tomcats. So once you neuter them, they also shed less of this protein.
Oh.
So we're actually kind of already making our cats a little bit more hypoallergenic by neutering them, strangely enough.
Yeah. And does it matter if they have long hair or short hair?
It doesn't really matter if they have long hair or short hair. Even cats that have no hair, you know, who have no hair at all, will also shed this protein. So there's some thought that maybe, going back to your question of what is it used for, that maybe it's actually used as kind of maybe a pheromone for social signaling. So this is probably going back to when cats were, you know, living in the wild, maybe they were around other cats. Probably less important now if that's the case, if you're a cat living by yourself in someone's apartment. But this gene is found in, you know, it's also found in lions, it's found in panthers, it's found in wild cats as well. But it seems to vary a lot from cat to cat. So that kind of suggests that maybe it's not that important, but we also really don't know.
Well, I remember a few years ago, there was this move to breed a hypoallergenic cat. What happened with that?
Yes, it didn't quite work. So there was one specific company that claimed it had bred a hypoallergenic cat, and it kind of turned out to be maybe a bit of a scam. That company has since gone away, but some of the people who got cats said that it still made them allergic. And some of the people paid thousands of dollars up front and never got a cat, which that kind of suggests to you, like, you know, how much demand there is for a hypoallergenic cat. So unfortunately, like a truly allergy-free cat is a myth. It doesn't really happen. Certain breeds maybe make slightly less of this protein than others, although we don't really have great evidence to really nail that down. But pretty much every single cat makes this protein.
So scientists now are trying to figure out how to dampen this protein, how to make it less potent for humans. And in one instance, they've actually created food. Nestle has a brand of cat food that can help.
Yeah, that's right. This is a food you can buy in the store right now. It's called Purina Live Clear. And the way this works is that it's actually a kibble, so a cat kibble that's coated in an antibody from egg yolks. And this antibody is specific. It recognizes that FeLD1 protein that people are allergic to. So when cats eat this kibble, the antibody on that kibble kind of gets in their mouth and neutralizes the allergens in their saliva. So it doesn't work right away. You know, it's not like you can feed this to them one day and they'll stop shedding this protein the next day. But over the course of several weeks, it does seem to decrease the amount of this protein that are shedding by about half. So again, it's not going down to absolute zero. But for some people, maybe for people whose allergies are not that severe, it might be enough that they can, you know, live with their cat.
So if you had a neutered cat and they ate this food, then maybe you're there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, for people who might have more severe allergies, that unfortunately might not be enough, but it is very much of a cat-to-cat, you know, person-to-person individual thing.
Okay. So there's another method that people are experimenting with, and that involves a vaccine for cats, not humans. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's right. So this is giving a cat a vaccine that basically makes them think that this FLD1 protein is actually a piece of virus. So that basically tricks the cat's immune system into attacking this protein. And so this is being done by, originally being studied by scientists in Switzerland. And they found that indeed over several weeks, the cats didn't make less of this protein. They made maybe just as much, but their levels started to drop once their immune system started neutralizing it. And they found that allergic cat owners were able to spend more time petting their cats once they've been vaccinated. And the company behind it is now kind of in the process of gathering the data to go through regulatory approval. Though it's kind of an interesting question, right? Like, this is a vaccine for cats, but it's really meant to treat humans. So who is supposed to regulate it?
I mean, do we care? We just want to get rid of this protein, right?
Yeah, but I think the question is it, as we were saying, we don't really know what this protein does. So does it cause any harm to the cat?
Yeah.
I think we probably do want to make sure that it doesn't before we start, you know, vaccinating lots and lots of cats. But that's what the data gathering is for.
Well, speaking of monkeying around with nature, there's also the gene editing technology CRISPR, where you could actually remove this FLD1 gene that encodes it.
Exactly. That's one of the other ideas that scientists have been investigating. So CRISPR, as you say, is this gene editing technology, and scientists have done this with cat cells in a petri dish. So they've been able to kind of knock out this FLD1 gene, and then presumably those cells would stop producing this protein. But, you know, we're talking about cat cells in a petri dish, so that's still pretty far from actually editing a cat or gene editing a cat. The company behind is interested in essentially making a gene therapy. So this would be like a shot that you maybe get for your cat, maybe once every few months, maybe once a year, that reduces the level of this protein, the FLD1 that they make.
So I guess this is the same ethical quandary that you'd have with the vaccine, that you're really altering something in the animal for our benefit. And we don't know if it benefits the animal, so it might hurt the animal to alter it in this way.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, would you do it? I don't know if you're allergic to cats, but
I'm not allergic to cats, but I think this is, you know, this quandary is at the crux of a lot of things we do to our cats, right? Like, it used to be that people would declaw their cats, and now that's really no longer acceptable. Of course, we still neuter our cats, and that makes them easier to keep in the apartment because, you know, they're not in heat, or they're not trying to find mates all the time. But obviously, that's a surgery, and that comes with risks as well, and it really changes the behavior of the cats. I think this is a really interesting question, and in fact, not just unique to these allergy shots, but really to a lot of things that we do to our pets.
Right, but they are domesticated, and they have been for a long time. So, and we breed them, and we feed them things that aren't live animals, so they are kind of far from their wild roots.
Yeah, yes. And I think with dogs, which are even more bred and in which there are, you know, lots of different breeds, where certain breeds have health problems, right? Mm-hmm. And we bred them for those characteristics that gave them those health problems because we liked how they looked. So I think this is really part of our like long relationship to our pets, where we're kind of shaping them to our desires. And sometimes it can be to the detriment, you know, to the individual animal. But also, you know, what if it means we love our cats more and we spend more time with them? Like, does that give them a better life? I think there's a lot to be probed about our relationship to our pets and what we want out of them.
And why do they lick themselves so much?
I should ask my cat who's next to me right now. He's sleeping right now and not grooming himself. I think it's, I don't know the exact answer, but I think it is like it's just part of the behavior where they like to keep themselves clean. So they're always grooming themselves. Funny enough, I was speaking to the scientist who developed that cat kibble and asking if they would ever do a dog version. And they were saying, well, it might be harder because dogs don't lick themselves.
Well, they do a little bit. Well, that does raise the issue. I'm allergic to dogs. Is there anything that in dog fur or saliva or whatever that could be also changed?
So unfortunately, I have some bad news for you, which is that dog allergies are a lot harder to treat just because dogs also make a large number of proteins that can cause allergies. And with cats, we're just talking about this one that causes most allergies. With dogs, there's just a number of proteins that can cause allergies. So it's just really harder, you know, instead of like one target, you're maybe talking about several. So it's just a lot harder.
So even if you get a poodly dog with hair, not fur, you're still up against a bunch of different proteins?
Yeah, that's right.
So is that kind of a myth, that those dogs are hypoallergenic?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's hypoallergenic pets are kind of a myth. So, you know, it's definitely true that, like, if your dog, whether they shed or not, like whether they shed fur or not, that might determine just like how much of the allergen they're like leaving around the environment and floating around, but they still make the proteins that make people allergic.
Wow. So people have gone on a doodle binge thinking that they're hypoallergenic and they're not. You're blowing my mind. Well, Sarah, thank you. As one cat owner to another, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Great talking to you too.
Sarah Zhang from The Atlantic, where you can read her piece, The Next Weird Way We're Changing Cats. And coming up, Adele releases her first album in 6 years, a review next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Go easy on me, baby. I was still a child. Didn't get the chance to. Well, after 6 years, music superstar Adele is back. Her new album is out this Friday. It's called 30. That's how old she was when she started writing the songs. She's now 33. And to promote its release, she, of course, talked to Oprah.
Is this the divorce album?
I think I'm divorcing myself on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does one do that?
So it's lonely. You know, I spent a lot of time on my own.
That interview was part of a 2-hour concert special, which aired last night on CBS. The concert was filmed at the Griffith Observatory here in Los Angeles. And here to talk about Adele's return is Chris Malamphy, pop music critic for Slate, and he also hosts the Hit Parade podcast. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, that concert, visually, it was stunning, right? It was at the Observatory, so outside, gorgeous, clear night, L.A. twinkling in the background. She's in this black evening gown, lots of celebs in the audience. What did you think of the actual performance?
I mean, I thought it was Adele at her best insofar as her voice sounds great. It's been observed by several people that when Adele had throat surgery about a decade ago, right at the height of her success with the 21 album, you know, I believe she had some throat nodules removed. Her voice actually got stronger. She's a stronger singer now than she was even a decade ago. And so if what you came for last night, if what you tuned in for was to hear Adele doing what she does best, you got plenty of that. She sounded great.
And she never really wavers, right? And all her albums, she provides the same kind of full-throated, you know, heartbreak, I guess. Songs about searching, yearning, finding, losing love.
Yeah, I have called her the queen of heartbreak, and I am not alone in that appellation. One of the most interesting questions in the Oprah interview I found, it was toward the end, Oprah said something to the effect of, you know, you seem very happy and settled. She's in a new relationship now. Can you write from a place of happiness?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the music will change.
Like love is, like, you know, the last song on the album.
Love's a game.
Yeah, it's about love.
Here's some of the lyrics. Love is a game for fools to play, and I ain't fooling. What a cruel thing to self-inflict that pain. And I wanted to know, are you, Adele, getting better at this game of love?
Yeah, I think so, because I don't treat it like a game anymore. You know, that thing of like, you're going to hurt me, so I'm going to hurt you first. I'm not like that anymore. Mm-hmm.
And it is an open question, right? Because over the course of 4 albums, dating all the way back to her debut 19 in 2008, Adele really has mined personal turmoil for her art. And you would have thought after 25, she might be in a settled place. She was having a kid. She was married to Simon, her husband. You might have thought that, you know, everything was all well in Adele's world. But now here she is divorced, a very amicable divorce by the sound of it. And what she's really distraught over, and you can hear it in the lead single Easy On Me, is what it might do to her kid. You know, Please Be Easy On Me is really addressed not so much to Simon, her ex-husband, but to Angelo, her child. And, you know, this is the wellspring from which Adele draws. And to your point, you know, there is a consistency, not to sound crass, but Adele gives you a consistent product, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you are getting some version of the same Adele you remember from 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And she is dropping back in like nothing has changed. You know, in the 6 years she's been gone, there have been several cycles of pop music, and Adele seems to float above all of it.
Okay, well, Easy On Me has been released. The rest of the album is going to be released at the end of the week. Let's play one clip from last night of another song. This one is called I Drink Wine.
You better believe I'm trying to keep climbing, but the higher we climb feels like we're both none the wiser. So I hope I learn to get over myself. Stop trying to be somebody else. So
as you say, she does not try to be somebody else in her music. How do you compare her to her contemporaries, people like Taylor Swift?
Yeah, let's remember that the album's called 30. She is now 33, but she's not, you know, a senior artist per se. She's been recording all of these albums of heartbreak, 25, 21, 19, at fairly tender ages, and she's only about a year older than Taylor Swift. But of course, from the jump, Adele has been an old soul, right? She is the artist that everyone from teenagers to your grandmother will relate to. And, you know, a middle-aged person, and I speak as a middle-aged person myself, if they only buy one album every couple of years, this may be the album they buy. They're not trying to keep up with trends. You know, in the 6 years since Adele last released an album, Taylor Swift has released four albums. Each of her albums sounds quite different from the last one. On one of them, Reputation, Taylor even tried rapping. Adele doesn't do any of that. Adele didn't come back and give you, you know, trap jams or reggaeton or, you know, I mean, really, you're laughing because
I can't even imagine it.
Right. You really can't. You know, Adele has her lane. She sticks to her lane. And, you know, the critic will carp that this means that, you know, you're not going to get surprises from Adele. But again, this is kind of what her fans show up for. They want to hear that voice. They want to hear, you know, the latest chapters in the telenovela that is Adele's life. She is still the queen of heartbreak. And, you know, even though there have been other artists like, you know, the young Tyro, Olivia Rodrigo, who's all of, I think, 19 years old, and she came out this year with Driver's License and became a different kind of queen of heartbreak. But, you know, Adele is still the reigning queen and she's reassumed her throne.
And how are people buying her album? Because, as we said, the one single has been released on Spotify and other streamers, but people don't buy albums. Even the middle-aged don't buy albums the way they used to.
That is very true. I mean, that's the other thing that's changed in the 6 years since Adele last dropped an album. This is remarkable to consider, but back in 2015, when she dropped 25, her prior album, she withheld it from Spotify and other streaming services for several months. That would be unthinkable now. You know, Adele, more than most artists, Taylor Swift is another, is the sort of person who does inspire people to buy stuff, actual physical goods, whether it's, you know, CDs back in 2015. Now, frankly, they're probably likelier to buy vinyl, ironically enough, now that, you know, vinyl has made a huge comeback in the last 6 years. But an overwhelming majority of people, you're right, are probably just going to stream this album. And, you know, Adele's got to compete in that realm. Back in 2015, 25 set a record that was thought unbeatable for most albums sold in a week. She sold 3.3 million albums in a 7-day period, beating a 15-year-old record by the band, the boy band, NSYNC. But in a way, that was kind of the twilight of the prior music economy. Even the digital download, which was still very strong in 2015. Adele sold, you know, 1.1 million copies of Hello in its first week. Easy on Me, when it was released, it is available to buy for, you know, a digital download for $1 or $1.29. And it sold a fraction of that because that's not how people consume music anymore. Folks are not lining up to pay, you know, $1 to buy Adele. They're going to stream this album. And it'll be interesting when the album finally drops to see what kind of numbers it does, because 3.3 million is probably impossible just physically. Like, there are stores that don't even carry CDs anymore. And it's also just folks have changed their patterns. Even before the pandemic, they were changing their patterns, and the pandemic only accelerated people's use of streaming services. So yeah, it's going to be a different world. She's kind of a Rip Van Winkle figure coming back after these 6 years.
Right. So when it comes to that, to buying the music, but what about going to see her perform live? I mean, her concert tickets must be fairly pricey, and she's got this robust audience that you spoke of, so she should do pretty well in that lane.
My understanding is that the tour is going to be limited. It may not be, you know, absolutely everywhere, but I'm sure she will do exceedingly well on tour. You know, she sat out most of the pandemic, and, you know, however haltingly, thanks to the Delta variant, concerts are coming back. And of course, the live arena is where Adele shines. You saw that in last night's performance. Not just, you know, her mellifluous voice, but, you know, just her between song banter. She's, you know, she's your chummy best friend.
Also, get you, Lizzo. You can come out, shine me, babes. I love that. I love that poncho coat. Oh, yeah, nice.
That's kind of the Adele persona, and she has not given that up.
Well, when you compare her to other of these kinds of diva songstresses, like Amy Winehouse, for example, where do you put her in the pantheon?
I mean, it's hard for people to remember this, but when Adele emerged in 2008, she was emerging very much in Amy Winehouse's shadow. And as part of, you know, a small boomlet of British soul singers, usually white soul singers, not just Amy Winehouse, but Duffy and, you know, Joss Stone. So, you know, Adele could have been just a part of that wave, but Adele is now exceptional. I mean, her instincts, her ear, her voice, she has exceeded all expectations for, you know, any of those artists. She is, you know, emerged from the shadow of Amy Winehouse, if she was ever in it. And that's to take nothing away from Amy Winehouse, who is a singular and amazing artist. But, you know, Adele was the best-selling global artist of the 2010s. Like, she owned that decade. And by the way, she only dropped 2 new albums during that entire decade. So she is, not to be, you know, cynical about this, but she's a brand. People know what they're getting when they get an Adele album, and they are more than happy to consume her just the way they remember a decade ago.
Well, Chris, thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Madeline.
Chris Malanfi, pop music critic for Slate, and he also hosts the Hit Parade podcast. And let's go out on one more new song from Adele's latest album. This one is called Hold On.
I'm my own worst enemy right now. I truly hate being me. Every day feels like the road I'm on might just open up and swallow me whole. How do I feel so mighty some more when I'm struggling to feel it all? Just hold on, let time be patient.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. And if you would like to listen to the show again, or if you missed any previous show, you can, of course, podcast us. You can download the podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.